Science writer David Quammen presented a talk at the Museum of the Rockies entitled Racing COVID, How Science Battled a New Global Pandemic, in which he discussed the origins of COVID-19, the most unexpected things he learned about it, and the compelling stories of scientists who raced to understand it and develop vaccines, as described in his new book, Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. The book has recently been announced as a finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction.
About an hour ago, I went online to check that I knew what time this event was happening. Suddenly I said, wait a minute, am I sure that it's 7 o'clock or is it 6 o'clock? So I went online and I just Googled Museum of the Rockies and my name, and up came a few things, some entries, and one of them said, David Quammen is speaking at the Museum of the Rockies, October 7th. And I thought, I did have a case of COVID a week or two ago, but I didn't think that I'd had to cancel or postpone this. I looked at it again a little more closely, and it said, October 7th, 2007. And that evening, the title of my talk was 13 Dead Gorillas, Zoonotic Disease, and the Future of Human Health, 2007. And actually, I came through these doors wearing a hazmat suit, just for laughs, and to illustrate a point, I guess. So this subject has been around. It's been around for me for a while. It's been around for scientists for a while. They saw it coming because I looked over their shoulders. I saw it coming, and hence this book. I'm going to talk to you about what's in the book. A lot of science, I hope lucidly and entertainingly explained, and why it's in the book. Before I do that, let me say a little bit about how the book happened, how it happened that I wrote this book at all. In January of 2007, I was at work on a completely different book about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon for my publisher, my dear publisher, Simon & Schuster. And I was preparing to go to Tasmania, the southern state of Australia, where Tasmanian devils live, because Tasmanian devils have a very extraordinary, contagious form of cancer that is threatening to kill off a large portion of the population. I'd written about that before, 15 years earlier in Harper's Magazine. That had led me toward this whole subject of cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. So I went to Tasmania. But before I went to Tasmania, it was January of 2020, and I got an email from an editor at the New York Times, an op-ed editor, who said, hey, Quammen, it's been a while. It's time for you to write another op-ed for us. Would you do that? About anything that you might be urgently interested in, or, for instance, this virus in Wuhan. And I said, yes, I do want to write an op-ed, and I want to write it about this virus in Wuhan, because this could be the deal. This could be the next big one. This could be very serious. Because I knew by that time that it was a coronavirus, and that rang a lot of bells. So I wrote this op-ed for the New York Times saying, hey, ladies and gentlemen, this could be very serious. This virus could be the cause of the next pandemic for the following reasons. And that op-ed was published January 28th in the New York Times. And then about a week later, I got on a plane for Tasmania. So I'm down in Tasmania. I get to Tasmania, and I'm going to spend most of my time bashing around in the bush with a bunch of Tasmanian devil biologists, helping them trap these animals and investigate whether they're infected with this contagious tumor and interviewing the scientists about this. But my email starts to light up with requests to talk, to flap my jaw about this new virus in Wuhan, China, because of the op-ed in the New York Times, but also because that steered people who needed steering to the fact that I had published a book about this subject back in 2012. 5 years after I did the 13 Dead Gorillas lecture here. At that point, when I did the lecture, I was already moving toward that book. So 2012, I published the book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. And the scientist that I talked to in that told me, yes, there is a pandemic coming. It will be caused by a virus, almost certainly an RNA virus, in particular, either an influenza virus or a coronavirus. So we said that in 2012. They said it through my voice. So I started getting all these things, all these requests to talk to people about, talk to China television and Russian television and Australian public radio and outfits in the US and radio stations in Europe, podcasts and Zooms and things. So I spent half my time in Tasmania doing that and the other half chasing around in the bush for Tasmanian devils that have a horrible facial cancer. I got on a plane, came back here to Bozeman, March 2nd, 2020, and then didn't get on another plane for more than 2 years. We all know what happened. It happened to all of us. It exploded. In about April or May, I heard from my publisher, Simon & Schuster, saying, why don't you push that little book about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon to the back of your desk and give us a book about the pandemic? You want a book about the pandemic? And I thought, well, every publisher in New York is going to want or have a book about the pandemic. So I thought about it very carefully for 4 or 5 seconds, and then I said, yes, I'll do that. And I thought, this is not an opportunity. This is a responsibility. This is a duty to do this book somehow. So I said yes, and they gave me a new contract for the new book. And I signed the contract. Now it's May of 2020. And then I have to think, okay, I've just violated two of my cardinal operating principles as a science writer. The first operating principle is don't write books about things that other people are writing books about. Write a book about island biogeography when nobody is writing books about island biogeography. Write a book about the history of molecular phylogenetics when nobody even knows what the devil that is. Write a book about zoonotic diseases in 2012 when people say, oh, gross, cute, interesting, marginal. Glad you found it fascinating, Quammen. But in this case, I was being asked to write a book about something that everybody was going to write a book about. Or a lot of writers, anyway. So, the other cardinal operating principle for me as a science writer is go there. If you're going to write about gorillas in the Congo that might be suffering from Ebola virus, go there. If you're going to write about viruses that might be carried by bats in southern China, bats that roost in caves, go there and crawl through the cave with the scientists. Etc. And that's how I had conducted my life as a science writer. Go there and write about things that nobody else is writing about. So now I realize I can't go anywhere. I can't get on a plane. First I thought, oh, I'll see how soon I can get on a plane to Wuhan, China. Ha, ha, ha. I still don't think I could get in there. Maybe especially not now. So I couldn't go there, and I was writing a book that a lot of other people were going to write a book about. So I spent the rest of 2020 trying to figure out how to solve those problems, how to write a uniquely valuable, fresh book about this subject that everybody's going to be sick of by the time you can finish a book, and lots of other writers are going to be writing books about. And write it from the 400 block of South Third in Bozeman. So I thought about that and thought about that, and I shuffled my feet for months, and I did a couple of feature articles for The New Yorker on aspects of the pandemic, aspects of the coronavirus. And I did a few more op-eds for the New York Times, and I shuffled my feet some more, and then I had double knee replacement surgery because it seemed like a good time to do that. I needed that anyway. Couldn't go anywhere. I did all of this, and that occupied 2020. And I got through 2020 on one tank of gas. I didn't leave Gallatin County for except one time to be a poll watcher in Townsend for the November election. So finally at the end of the year, I had an idea. I got a brainstorm. I got a concept of how maybe I could do this book. This is like, you know, Christmas or New Year's Eve of 2020. And I had the idea that the way I will do this book, or try to, is first of all, I will make the virus my main character. I will put the virus in the center of the book. I will write about the origin and evolution of this virus and its fierce journey through the human population. And I would do that by assembling a Greek chorus of voices, scientists around the world who study viruses and who study coronaviruses in particular and who study this virus in particular. And I would contact them and ask them if I could perhaps do a Zoom interview with each of them, an extended Zoom interview. I asked for an hour and a half from each of them. An hour and a half Zoom interview is my ask, and I want to ask you about your work on this virus in particular, your views of this virus as a professional scientist, but also your life as a person during the pandemic, your life as a lab leader, as a teacher, as a parent, as a spouse, as possibly a son or a daughter of elderly parents. I want to ask about your personal life during the pandemic. So I started sending emails in the first days of January 2021 I made a whole list of scientists, my wish list of 60 or 70 scientists I thought I wanted to get this sort of interview from. And I started emailing them, and I got a few that ignored me and a few that said, no, I'm too busy, and many, many that said, yes, okay, I will do that. I will do that. So I started doing these interviews all around the world, Sydney, Australia, Hong Kong, Beijing, Bangkok, Rotterdam, Bozeman, Raina Plowright, Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, all around the world, Edinburgh. And started doing these interviews with these people, and I had this sort of protocol of questions, the first half of which in each case was specific to their work. And by the time I talked to them, I would have read their journal papers, read their scientific papers, a lifetime of scientific papers on coronaviruses in some cases. And I would be ready with very specific technical questions about what they thought and what they had learned in their investigation of this virus, which we now know by the name SARS-CoV-2. COVID-19 is the disease, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. I would ask them about the virus, and then the last third of the interview, I would ask them, what's the most important decision you made during 2020? How has it affected your work? Is your lab still open? Anybody in your family gotten very sick? Anybody in your family died? Have you lost anybody? How are your kids doing? And I asked these questions of everybody I talked to. I asked them of George Gao, the director of the China CDC, and KYUN, this brilliant coronavirus expert in Hong Kong, and Tony Fauci, and Barney Graham of the Vaccine Research Center, and Sharon Peacock, who founded the sequencing consortium in the United Kingdom, and graduate students in Edinburgh that nobody had ever heard of, but who were doing brilliant work on this virus, and lots of other people. And that took me the first half of 2021. Meanwhile, my trusted and conscientious transcriber, Gloria Thede, over in Pray, Montana, in Paradise Valley, was transcribing these transcripts for me. 30 pages for this person, 35 pages for that person. And I got all these transcripts and I printed them out. So I had all these piles of journal articles and I had piles of transcripts and I had shelves of books. And in about the middle of June, I started writing because I was aware that I was on a deadline. Simon & Schuster said, here's a contract, a nice contract, but your delivery date is December 31st, 2021. This is an urgent subject and we want to get this book out, so don't waste any time. So essentially I had 6 months to write the book. And I started and I worked hard and I hit send on December 18th. And my editor and the publisher, Simon Schuster, what? You're an author and you're on time? In fact, you're 2 weeks early? And so they were grateful about that. And then there was more work, more fact-checking that went into it, and the book now finally is published. So I'm going to talk about what's in the book. First of all, the virus, SARS-CoV-2. We live in a world of viruses. There are viruses in every cellular creature, on the kind of cellular creature on the planet. Viruses, as you know, are not cells, they are genetic parasites. They can only replicate themselves by inserting themselves into a living cell, the cell of an animal, a plant, a fungus, a bacteria, or some other microbe, and they hijack the machinery in the interior of the cell, and they make copies of themselves, and they come busting out and infect some other cells. That's what they do. Everything comes from somewhere, and the viruses that infect humans come almost without exception, from wild animals. Because we are animals. In fact, we are mammals. And so most of the viruses that are new to humans, causing these sudden emerging infections, are mammal viruses that have spilled over, hence the title of my earlier book, spilled over from mammals into humans. In some cases, from birds. The influenzas, for instance. Very serious group, diverse group of fast-evolving viruses that come to us from wild aquatic birds. New influenzas come from wild aquatic birds. And then they get into domestic poultry, they get into ducks and geese that are dabbling around in rice paddies in Southeast Asia or wherever, and then they get into humans. That's where influenzas come from birds. Most of our other viruses come from mammals because we are mammals and the viruses only have to change themselves, evolve, adapt to a certain degree in order to infect a different kind of mammal host. And if the virus is capable of rapid change and therefore rapid adaptation by Darwinian natural selection, the virus is more likely to be able to spill. I say spill, not leap, because viruses are passive, from a non-human host into a human. And then that becomes what we call a zoonotic infection. Animal infections that become human infections cause zoonotic diseases. That's what that term is about. So if it's a fast-evolving virus, it's able to do that. So which of the viruses are fast-evolving? Well, this one, for one, but why? Well, this one belongs to a certain category. It belongs, as you well know, to the coronaviruses. That's a family of viruses. They all have those coronas of spikes sticking out of them, like cloves sticking out of a baked ham. And those spikes are what they use to latch onto a cell and then insert their genome into the cell and start the process of replicating itself in the cell and destroying that cell. So coronaviruses belong to a group called the RNA viruses. RNA as opposed to DNA. DNA is the double helix molecule. We're all very familiar with that. Double spiral, double helix of nucleoproteins, nucleic acids, and this spiraling shape that gives it a certain stability. But there's another kind of nucleic acid, RNA, ribonucleic acid. That's not a double helix. That is generally a single strand. So it doesn't have the same stability. When it replicates itself inside a living cell, it's more inclined to make mistakes in copying. And those mistakes don't get corrected in RNA viruses, generally. And so RNA viruses have a higher net mutation rate than DNA viruses, and therefore they are capable of faster change, faster adaptation, faster evolution to new situations, new environments, meaning new kinds of hosts. They are also capable of a little trick that's very important in the story of SARS-CoV-2, and that is something called recombination. Recombination means swapping sections, not just changing increments of the virus, one letter by one letter of the genetic code. By the way, here's the genetic code, in case anybody is curious, of SARS-CoV-2. It goes on for 12 pages. This is the first two. And here's what it sounds like. It'll be very interesting to you, I'm sure. ATTAAAGGTTTATACCTTCCCAGGTAACAA, et cetera, for 30,000 letters. That's the genetic code of SARS-CoV-2. In the form that it came out of Wuhan in January of 2020. And we all know it's been changing since then. So recombination is the trick that allows the virus to swap whole sections, like a whole paragraph of this, swap it with another coronavirus in the same cell that happens to be replicating at the same time and bring in that paragraph from the other coronavirus. Recombination, so that besides evolving incrementally, letter by letter, A, C, T, G, it can evolve by leaps through this recombination. The influenzas are capable of that too in a slightly different form. But it's very important with the coronaviruses because this virus has probably been assembled not just by incremental mutation over millions of years, but also by recombination that could have happened in the last 10 years, 5 years, 20 years, swapping in whole sections from other coronaviruses that happen to infect the same animal at the same time. And if they infect the same cell at the same time, then this accidental swapping of sections can occur. The other thing that's important to know about this virus is that when scientists first looked at it, when they got this, when the really smart people who are molecular evolutionary virologists got the first genome, and I'll talk about how they got the first genome, they said, well, there are two peculiar things about this. I mean, it's about 80% similar to the SARS virus of 2003, the earlier SARS coronavirus that came out of southern China in 2003 and spread by airplane from Hong Kong and ended up infecting about 8,000 people and killing about 800 people. A serious, dangerous virus, killing one person in 10, a respiratory virus. But it was not transmissible by asymptomatic cases. You didn't shed the virus until you were really sick and showing that you were spreading it. And that was one of the main reasons why scientists and public health officials were able to stop that 2003 outbreak at only 8,000 people and 800 deaths, because it didn't have that. And the scientists were saying back in 2003, and I was saying in 2012 when I published Spillover, wow, it sure was lucky that that wasn't capable of asymptomatic spread, because if it had been that virus plus asymptomatic spread, whew, could have been a terrible pandemic. So that's what we got. So the scientists look at this in January of 2020, and they say, okay, it's 80% similar to the SARS coronavirus. It's 96% similar to this one virus from a horseshoe bat in China that a scientist named Zhengli Shi at the Wuhan Institute of Virology found from a sample. She didn't grow it in her laboratory. She just took a sample from a bat and she sequenced the fragments of genome and she assembled a genome and found a virus that she named RATG13, or I like to call it RATG13. Never mind why, but that's been a famous virus in this story, RATG13. Why is it famous? Because from the beginning, for about a year, it was the closest match that we had to this virus from any wild animal ever sampled by science. 96.2% similar. But 96.2% similar at the rate that coronaviruses mutate and evolve means probably 40 or 50 years of genetic divergence. So that virus is not the precursor of this virus. That virus is a cousin of this virus, and the cousin has been living in Milwaukee for 40 years, while the other virus has been living in Oslo, not staying in touch. So they've diverged to the degree of essentially 4% difference. So it's a clue, but it's not the answer to where this virus came from. So then the scientists also say, okay, there are two curious, to put it politely, alarming, odd, perplexing aspects of this new virus. One is that there is a feature, and both of these are in the spike protein, in those cloves that stick out of the hand. One of them is called a receptor binding domain, and that's essentially the jaws of that spike that sticks out, all those spikes. The receptor binding domain. No, and it's not right to call it the jaws. Maybe call it the canine teeth. Call it the canine teeth of that spike, so that when the spike lays hold of a protein on the outside of a cell to try and get in, those canine teeth take hold particularly strongly and cause a connection, cause a contact, cause a seizure of that virus. And then the second peculiar feature is called, and none of this will be on the quiz at the end of the lecture, is called the furin cleavage site. Furin cleavage site. Furin cleavage site, never mind why furin. Furin is a molecule that we have in our bodies. And if it gets to the spike in this protein, it triggers a latch in the middle of the spike, and the spike changes shape, just like, you know that movie, those movies, Transformers? So suddenly a robot changes into the shape of a truck, or a truck changes into the shape of a big menacing robot. The spike changes shape, it fuses with the membrane of the cell, and then the genome is injected, the genome of the virus is injected into the cell, and that's a done deal then. The cell has been infected. So these two things, a receptor binding domain, RBD, and a furin cleavage site, FCS, are in this genome, and the scientists are saying, where did they come from? Curious. We need an explanation for that. We haven't seen that before in a SARS-like coronavirus. The original SARS did not have those. SARS-like coronaviruses, they hadn't seen those. So they thought, so then people who listened a little bit, but not carefully enough, to the experts said, oh, well, those are suspicious. Those must have been put in there by engineering, genetic engineering. This is an engineered virus. Somebody inserted a receptor binding domain that binds well to human cells, and somebody inserted a furin cleavage site that binds well to binds to the membrane and helps the virus insert its genome. Very suspicious. The serious scientists, meanwhile, were saying, let's think about this carefully. That's one possibility. And then there are a number of other possibilities. The virus might have picked these things up by recombination, swapping in sections from some other kind of virus. Do these features exist anywhere in the wild? Is there already a receptor binding domain that looks like this receptor binding domain? Is there a furin cleavage site that looks like this furin cleavage site in the wild among other coronaviruses? And the short answer is yes, they found them. They found them in other coronaviruses. So suddenly it was not nearly as mysterious or suspicious. This is all happening now during late January. There's a group of scientists, and they're all in my book, they're sources, Eddie Holmes in Sydney, Australia, and Christian Anderson at the Scripps Research Institute, and Andrew Rambeau in Edinburgh, Robert Gary in New Orleans. And they have a conference call with Tony Fauci and Francis Collins, who's head of the NIH. He's Tony Fauci's boss, he was, on February 1st to talk about this. What do you think? Looking at this genome, what do you think, you guys? And Dr. Fauci is asking Eddie and Christian, what do you think? What does this tell you? You guys are the experts. You tell us. And what they said was, well, we got to keep all the possibilities on the table, but these things look like they came from the wild. We found them in the wild. Around that time, do I have time to tell that story? One of my favorite characters, there's a fellow named Matt Wong. Matt Wong. He's in Houston at the a medical school there. Baylor School of Medicine. He's a techie in the lab of a fellow that studies the microbiome at the Baylor School of Medicine. But he's just this young guy. He's not a PhD student. He doesn't even have a master's degree. He's a bioinformatician. He's a wizard on the computer. And he gets interested in this. And he says, I wonder if I went online and pulled down a bunch of genomes of coronaviruses that have been genome sequenced around the world, I wonder if I could find any matches with this new virus coming out of Wuhan. And just noodling around late at night, he finds a match. He finds the receptor binding domain in this virus closely resembles the receptor binding domain in a coronavirus that infects pangolins. Pangolins, those wonderful little animals that look like anteaters covered with armadillo scales, but they're not related to armadillos, and they're not related to anteaters. They have long tongues. They eat ants. Four species in Africa, four species in southern China, trafficked all over the world, trafficked from Africa to Vietnam and China for their meat, which is considered a delicacy, and for their scales, which are considered medically significant, even though the scales are keratin, just like our fingernails, nothing really there. So these horribly abused animals are trafficked in the millions to southern China and Vietnam in this trade. And they carry viruses, including coronaviruses. And when they're put into the wild meat trade that's flowing toward the big cities of southern and central China, all these animals that are captured from the wild and put in cages and stacked on top of one another in trucks and then taken to wet markets and left stacked on top of one another, and they're defecating and they're urinating and they're, the pangolins, some of them were sobbing. I found in one of the scientific sources of sobbing pangolins, having this respiratory trouble, and they're sharing viruses. So Matt Wong, I talked to him. At this point, he's not in Baylor. At Baylor in Houston, he's at a pool tournament in Las Vegas because his pool team has won the Houston finals and they've given a trip to Las Vegas. So I get him on Zoom and he's there in Las Vegas playing pool and telling me, I was doing this stuff and I found this. And I thought it might be important. And then Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash on January 26th. 2020, Kobe Bryant dies in a helicopter crash. And Matt Wong says, Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash. Life is short. I should be doing something significant. I'm going to find out where this receptor binding domain came from and whether it is important in this new virus. And he finds it, and he matches it. And he puts it up on the web, just at a website for sharing half-baked ideas. And Christian Anderson sees it on the website. He doesn't sign his own name. He signs his internet name, which is TorpTube. So TorpTube puts this up, and the best molecular evolutionary virologists in the world spot it and say, TorpTube just told us where this receptor binding domain came from. It comes from the wild. Natural selection has produced it in a coronavirus that infects pangolins, and there's every chance in the world, therefore, that it could exist in this coronavirus that infects probably horseshoe bats and now is in humans. Anyway, so I tell his story. I get his voice. I get Eddie Holmes, this brilliant scientist in Sydney. Eddie Holmes is working with a Chinese scientist named Zhou Zhang. Eddie Holmes is like a consulting expert at looking at this kind of thing and saying, well, I can tell you 10 different things about the evolutionary history of this series of A, C, T's, and G's. So Eddie Holmes is working with Chinese scientists, and now I'll jump back to early January, January 5th, January 6th. He hears from his collaborator in Shanghai, Professor Zhang, Zhou Zhang, who says, calls him on WeChat and says, Eddie, it's a coronavirus. It looks similar to SARS. Oh, okay, that's serious. We need to get this sequenced. We need to get this out. Talk to the public health people. Let them know it's probably a coronavirus. Respiratory transmission might even be capable of asymptomatic transmission. Very serious, Zhang. We got to get this out. But Zhang has a lot of pressure on him from Chinese authorities who are telling everybody, stop working on this virus, stop talking about this virus, do not share any information about this virus. And then it gets to be January 10th, and Zhang's lab has sequenced the entire virus. They've assembled the entire 30,000 letters from samples that they have, and they can see this, the genome of this virus in its entirety. And they're saying, well, we got to write a scientific paper. And Eddie Holmes is saying, no, scientific paper, fine, but we need to get this genome out. It needs to be public. And everybody in the world who's working on this and trying to develop vaccines needs to have this genome sequence as soon as possible. Zhang, you got to release it. Zhang has the sequence. Eddie does not have the sequence. Eddie is on the phone in Sydney, Australia. And so finally, on, the morning of January 11th, he gets a call. Eddie gets a call. Eddie is telling me all this. Eddie gets a call from Zhang. And Zhang says, I'm on a plane. I'm headed for Beijing. I'm going to talk to my bosses. And Eddie says, we got to release the sequence, Zhang. And Zhang says, let me think for a minute, Eddie. And he's buckling his seatbelt. And they're telling him, you know, we're closing the door. Turn off your phone. Wait. He's talking to Eddie in Sydney. And finally he says, okay, Eddie, we'll release the sequence. We'll release the sequence of the virus. I may get in a lot of trouble, but I'm going to be in the air for 2 hours and nobody can stop me. So release the sequence. I'm telling my postdoc back in my lab, send you the file that's got the 30,000 letters in it. And he sends that to Eddie. And Eddie tells me, I get the sequence. I get this file. It's in a particular form. And Eddie says to me, Eddie tells me he has it in his possession for 52 minutes. He has already arranged with a website, the same website that TorpTube published on, which is run out of Edinburgh by a brilliant evolutionary virologist, and it's for publishing things that are not yet scientific papers, graphs, data, ideas, hypotheses, brainstorming. And it's run by Andrew Rambo, who's a gold friend of Eddie's from Oxford. And so Eddie is talking to Andrew Rambo on the phone. It's midnight in Edinburgh. It's Sunday morning, the 11th anyway of January, Saturday morning in Sydney. And Eddie is saying, I got the sequence. And Andrew says, okay, we got to compose an introduction. And they compose a quick introduction saying this comes from the laboratory of Zhu Zhang in Shanghai, et cetera. These people worked on it. It is their proprietary, but it is for the use of anybody. Feel free to copy this genome, to share this genome, to use this genome in your vaccine development. It's for the world. It's for the public. And after 52 minutes, it goes up live on that website. And Eddie tells me, he says, I didn't even check what it is, what kind of a genome it was. He said, it could be bloody glowworm DNA, he told me, for all you know. But it went up on this website. And then Barney Graham of the Vaccine Research Center has been saying to his boss, who is Tony Fauci, just get me the sequence. We're all set to go. As soon as we get the sequence of this virus, we're set to go moving on this idea that we have, this platform we have, which is called an mRNA virus. But we need the sequence of the virus. We need to know the sequence of the spike protein so we can create essentially dummies or effigies of that spike protein in our vaccine. And those effigies, those dummies, will provoke the human immune system to be on the lookout for those spike proteins and stop the virus. That's how you do a vaccine, in particular an mRNA vaccine. Tony Fauci has been telling telling Barney, I'll get you the genome, we'll get you the genome, and as soon as you get the genome, just go, go, go. I'll get you the money, I'll get you the support. As soon as we get the genome, just go and develop your mRNA vaccine. So Barney Graham gets the genome off of that website in Edinburgh at 8 or 9 p.m. on the evening of Friday, January 10th, and he immediately starts making decisions about what sort of choices to make in terms of creating the effigies, creating the dummies that will stimulate the immune system, that will resemble not just the spike protein after it has latched onto the cell, but the spike protein before it latches onto the cell, which is the crucial time. So you need your immune system to be sending out antibodies that can stop that spike protein before it latches onto the cell and changes shape like that transformer truck. Barney Graham makes those calls. He makes those choices about what to do, how to create an effigy for this particular spike on the virus, and he gives it to his people, his young postdocs and graduate students, and they start working on developing those. They're called antigens, the dummies, and he's in touch with Stéphane Bancel, if I remember his name correctly, who's the head of Moderna, and they've been working together. And Bancel has been saying, as soon as you get the sequence, as soon as you get the you can design the antigen, you can design the dummy, we will start to manufacture. So they did that, and I think it was 58 days after that evening when Barney Graham got the sequence from Eddie Holmes, who got it from Zhang. 58 days until the first Moderna shot went into the arm of the first person volunteered for clinical testing. That's just a start. This is a breathless story.
You've been listening to science writer David Quammen presenting a talk at the Museum of the Rockies entitled Racing COVID, How Science Battled a New Global Pandemic, drawing from his new book, Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. Recorded October 19th, 2022.